Hi, this is Connie Hunter, KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio, Community Conversations show host. Today I'm talking to Brookings City Manager Gary Millman. We have lots of exciting things to talk about as usual. So Gary, welcome. Thank you for being here, and how are you doing today?
Glad to be here, doing just fine.
You know, Gary, every time I go to a city council meeting, I learn something. But today I want to also talk about your weekly reports, because I learn a lot from those. So I want to highlight the weekly report. Not only do I read them regularly and become more informed, but I think the topics are important for discussion, and people can get on the email list and get the work report too, huh? The weekly work report. So how can citizens get a hold of the weekly work report, Gary?
Well, I do a weekly report to the city council, and it is distributed on Fridays to the city council. And then we do have a group of citizens who've requested to receive it as well, and they can do that by contacting Lori Zeemer here at City Hall, either by email or at 541-469-1103.
So the first thing I want to talk about from the weekly report, I keep wanting to call it a work report, weekly report, is storytelling. And you know, I'm kind of a storyteller when I'm talking at city council or at the board of commissioners or just in life, because as a nonprofiteer, we always like to put a face on it. So what I appreciate about your weekly report is that you give great information, but tell some great stories too. Kind of reminds me of a feature writer in a newspaper. So one story that I really liked in your weekly report for the week ending February 5th, 2016 is the story about the stop sign back in 1973. I graduated from high school in 1973, so I'm smiling, but wanted you to tell the story because I really liked the conclusion that you drew.
Well, in 1973, I was serving on the city council in the city of Maywood, California, a city of about 20,000 in urban Los Angeles County. Today is the most densely populated city in California. But then it was a middle-class community, working-class community, and I was appointed to an unexpired term on the city council. And I was working at the time in a neighboring city as the deputy city manager, and was attending graduate school in public administration. So, looking at it from a management perspective, you look at when issues come to the city, my training was that you look at the factual information, the engineering reports, and the data, and base your recommendations based on the data. But an elected official, I found, and through that educational experience, that you need to look at it a little differently. And so this example that I used coming to the city council in 1973 is that we had a group of residents who came to the city council requesting the installation of a stop sign, a four-way stop at an intersection in town, because they perceived that there was a safety problem at that intersection. Well, we didn't have any reports of traffic accidents, no pedestrians hit in the crosswalk, no reports of near misses, nothing in the police files. Engineering looked at it, took traffic counts, determined that it didn't meet what are called warrants for a stop sign. We heard from engineers and public works and law enforcement that you really shouldn't erect a stop sign at a location where there's a low volume, because if people driving up to the stop sign always find that there is no cross traffic to stop for, that they'll eventually start ignoring the stop sign, and then that creates an accident. So it's all of that kind of data that is presented at the city council meetings. But ultimately, as an elected official, you listen to the people who are living across the street from the intersection, and that's to whom you respond. So all of the data aside, all of the professional recommendations aside, we ultimately approved a stop sign at that location. But stop signs and crosswalks, I believe, are not always the best answer, because I believe that there is an element there that if you have a safety device that people begin to perceive as not really accomplishing anything, they tend to ignore it, and that creates a new hazard. So it's a real difficult balance between what the public perception is and what the professionals tell you based upon years of experience. So that's a part of the challenge of being an elected official.
And I think the main point that I liked beyond that is, and I think the way that it was said, words to that effect in the work report, was the voter's always right.
The voters are always right.
So anyway, since it's election time, let's make sure that we get some people out there and register to vote. So young people, if you're end up on this podcast trying to learn more about municipal government, please get registered to vote. Anyway, let's go on to the next thing. NDRC, since Community Conversations followed the Natural Disaster Resilience Competition's effort for the City of Brookings very closely, I know that we didn't receive funding for that grant application. There's another issue that has come up, though, and I found this pretty interesting. And, of course, because of who you are, you're making sure that, you know, there's a benefit to that, and there was a benefit that possibly was overlooked. There's an additional issue regarding the HUD piece of the puzzle that's sometimes referred to as a consolation prize, and that means the state of Oregon should have gotten some money. And so can you elaborate on that?
Sure. In the National Disaster Resiliency Competition process, there were 40 entities, cities and states and counties, that were invited by HUD to submit applications. There was a first round where they reviewed all of the applications and then selected 40 that they felt had projects that would compete well, and invited those entities to submit full applications. And we, Brookings, was a part of the state of Oregon application. So our projects were all sub-projects to the state of Oregon, and Reedsport was the other city partner. So we went through that process, and HUD rated all of the applications and selected 17 of the 40 for funding. So 23 of the applicants were not funded. We didn't expect all of the applicants to be funded. We kind of expected that we'd get some funding through the program, because we thought our proposals were pretty competitive based upon the workshops that we attended with the Rockefeller Foundation and HUD. But being as it may, we didn't get any of the projects funded. But there was a provision that was included in the legislation that there was to be a $30 million set-aside within the NDRC program to provide funding to entities that didn't receive a full grant award, and that the minimum allocation was to be $1 million. And if you read the formula contained in the legislation, Oregon actually could have qualified for about $2.5 million. So we, our state, Oregon, inquired, when can we have a debriefing, and what's the process for claiming our million, or, you know, the consolation prize, as it came to be known. And the feedback from HUD was that, well, we allocated all of the money available to the 17 grant recipients, and we didn't set aside the $30 million that's provided for in the notice of funding, the grant funding. So we've asked our congressional representatives to look into that, and that's what they're doing. And so haven't received a response yet. The response from HUD was that they believed it was optional as to whether they would set aside the $30 million. But the way that the announcement is written and all of the workshops that we attended sure didn't seem like it was optional to the applicants. So we'll see what happens here, but it's still unresolved.
Well, I hope that $1 million consolation prize comes our way, because there's no consolation here. You just did a great job on that grant, and the community participation could have been a little bit more. We tried to, you know, get people involved. And I think what is really the key here, the most important part of that, is each standalone project can be a grant application under another, maybe USDA rural development. So you want to talk a little bit more about that?
We're pursuing that. We are talking with USDA and with the State Community Development Block Grant Program, which is HUD funding, to pursue funding for portions of the, and also with DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, to pursue funding for portions of the application that the City of Brookings developed projects for. In addition to that, I just learned this week that Coos Cree Electric Cooperative, who also had a project included in the state's NDRC application, wasn't funded. It was about $4 million, as I recall, to replace transmission lines in the Brookings area, to upgrade the transmission lines from wood poles to steel poles from Carpenterville Road down through to about Old County Road, connecting several of their power stations, upgrading it to be more resilient. It didn't receive funding under NDRC, but they're planning to proceed with that project anyway. And we've seen their preliminary design plans, and they're actually going ahead with the geologic testing at the locations for the poles. And I think they're planning on being under construction this year on that project, funding it on their own.
That's fantastic. And, you know, Gary, one of the things that I attended recently was the USDA Rural Development Workshop up in Bend, and I really learned a lot. Not only did they go through everything about broadband, but there was a lot of information about all the other grants that are available through USDA Rural Development. And, you know, when I first came to Brookings and talking with people, people that don't understand grants and grant funding sometimes say, hey, it's federal money, we don't want it. But the bottom line is we pay our federal taxes, and doing the hard work to get it back into our local economy and into our local infrastructure and public facilities, that's a lot of hard work that you have to do. So the NDRC grant competition actually put us in a position to know where we best fit for some of the other grants. Is that a correct assessment?
That's right. You know, we had some, we've done a lot of the groundwork now for the projects that were included in that application, and it will make it easier to be more competitive as we identify other funding sources for that. And you're correct. Folks who live in Brookings pay federal taxes, and this is a way to get some of that tax revenue back. Just as we are about ready to proceed with the airport infrastructure project, we received bids this week on that project, and it's a $2.3 million construction project. And we are happy to see that the low bid was a local contractor. McLennan Excavation of Brookings is the low bidder. We're scheduled to award the bid in March. So they would have about a $2.3 million contract for the water and sewer infrastructure construction up to the Brookings Airport. 60% of that is federally funded. So we'll have over $1.5 million in federal dollars coming into the community to pay local wages for the construction of that project. So there is a benefit to the community in job creation, at least short term during the construction, and that will put the airport in a much better position for future development to create more private sector jobs.
And I appreciate you bringing up the airport project, because I neglected to have this on my outline of the things that I wanted to talk to you about today. So thanks for bringing that up. And we'll talk more about that project specifically at some point, because I think it's very interesting and the potential there is huge. So we're going to move on, unless there's something else you want to say about the airport project right now. Coming up in March, we're having the Curry County League of Women Voters is having three forums on homeless resources. The forum for Brookings is March 15th at 5:30 p.m. at Southwestern Oregon Community College, Curry Campus, in the Krieger Community Room. And the panel so far includes Brookings Police Department Sergeant Kelby McCray, Janice Scanlon, Executive Director of the Brookings Harbor Food Bank, Mike Lehman, Executive Director of Oregon Coast Community Action, who's named mostly, people hear it as ORCA, Maria Walker from Oregon Employment Department, and others. So I greatly appreciate your weekly report for the week ending February 12th, because it talked about homeless shelter needs and the city of Fort Bragg, California's hospitality house. I'd like to make sure that the hospitality house is mentioned at the forums in March. Can you tell us about hospitality house in Fort Bragg, where you used to be the city manager? Because I think that's a great example of the kinds of things that can be community-based and not be a big expense to the city, but provide services to those in need.
Sure. This is an issue that's been around now for decades. It's getting a lot of attention now, but this issue, when I was the city manager in Fort Bragg, almost 20 years ago now, was a hot topic then in that community of a very similar demographics and size to Brookings. In Fort Bragg, we had a private party, Jenny Kreinhop, who owned and operated Jenny's Giant Burgers, the non-franchise hamburger joint in Fort Bragg. And she was a member of my church, and got involved individually in trying to deal with the homeless issue. She had folks coming, of course, to her restaurant seeking help. And was aware of the assistance that was being provided to homeless folks through our church. So she went out on her own and rented a building in town, a residence, and opened it as a homeless shelter. And then she gathered some other members of the church community together, and they started providing a way that they would staff that facility, and were able to secure food and clothing and assistance in finding people jobs, and it just took on a life of its own. And ultimately, I believe they moved into a larger residential facility and expanded it to, I think initially it was 3 or 4 families, and then it was 7 or 10 families, and it's still operating today, completely as a nonprofit with minimal participation by government. I mean, while I was there, they never requested any money from the city for the facility. It was entirely a grassroots program, and it was very successful. So that's, I wouldn't say a model for all. But that is an approach that did work in that small community by gathering community members together, churches and nonprofits and just individuals who would support the facility. They hooked up with a food bank and hooked up with the markets for food and secured supplies from other retailers and worked with the community to get people the training and the jobs that they needed. So now we're dealing with this issue in Brookings, as well as other parts of Oregon. The League of Oregon Cities recently, they have a monthly magazine, and one of their recent monthly magazines dedicated the entire issue to the homeless topic and provided examples of what other communities are doing to try to address the homeless topic in Ashland and Eugene, and then some of the smaller communities as well. And there are a variety of approaches that have been taken. And it seems that the message I got from reading that publication is that each community has come up with its own unique approach based upon the circumstances on the ground and the resources available or not available in that community. So that's where I am with the homeless issue. I've experienced a program that was successful, and looking at other communities who have had mixed success with some of the programs that they've tried, and I'm happy to see that there's a community effort to try to address this and not relying entirely on government for the answers, because we don't have them.
Well, the bottom line is we're all in it together. And the function of a nonprofit is, in my opinion, is to build the things that government doesn't have time or maybe the resources or maybe sometimes the political will to get things done. And we all know that with regards to the homeless issue, if you have services, then homeless people will show up, and not everybody wants homeless services in their neighborhood. And that's always been an issue. When I worked for the fundraising and development arm of the largest community mental health center in the state of Arizona, our offices were in North Phoenix and the services were delivered in South Phoenix. And in order to get our board of directors down to the South Phoenix Community Mental Health Center, we literally had to borrow vans from the Circle K fleet vans and take them down there as a group. And it made sense to us to hear the complaints of merchants and to, you know, look at, does it make sense to have panhandling ordinance or no panhandling ordinances, things like that. So what I know is there are a lot of commonalities in homeless issues, but certainly any nonprofit worth its salt is going to build a custom-built community-serving entity. And I just, because of the comparable with Fort Bragg, I just think that was a great example. And if you have that magazine that you referred to, I would love to have a copy of that, and I think it might be useful as maybe to draw some more information to give out at those League of Women Voters forums. And I'll make sure in the narrative of this podcast that I include all three dates. So I really appreciate you talking about that. And then I want to get on to the VA and our Curry County veterans. Recently, in your weekly report, you gave kudos to the VA Roseburg Healthcare System Stakeholders Meeting. As part of KCIW outreach and community conversations, our volunteers and sponsor Liberty Advocacy Group Incorporated were able to bring folks together on behalf of veterans in support of local healthcare and mental health care. Briefly, do you want to tell me what the benefits you think this stakeholders meeting will have for our local veterans and for our local healthcare providers and mental health care providers?
I think awareness in the community of continuing veterans' concerns and issues I think the recent meetings with Director Paxton was very valuable in raising the level of awareness with the bigger VA entity about the needs in the community as well. I liked a lot of the things I heard about trying to push healthcare back to the local communities and identify resources that already exist within the communities that they can work off of rather than centralizing everything in Roseburg or some other places. You know, thinking back to when Dave Gordon was on the city council, who was a disabled veteran, and the talking about storytelling, the stories he would tell me about making arrangements and appointments in Roseburg just to have his hearing aid tuned or a battery replaced and getting partway there and having his appointments canceled, or and the amount of money that it would cost him to travel over there for a short visit. Those kinds of things, I think, if we can bring those services into the communities, as was discussed at the one at the forum that I attended, I think those will be great benefits to veterans. But there are obviously veterans' needs beyond healthcare for in housing, and we need to be taking action to address those as well. So I think the greatest benefit has been increasing the level of awareness. And beginning to identify resources to try to address those issues.
And I really appreciated Director Paxton and his staff for being receptive, not only to doing that stakeholders meeting sooner rather than later, but to really look at our local service providers, because if we can keep those dollars local and provide service is local, that helps everybody. That in and of itself is a little bit of an economic driver. We know that healthcare is an economic driver, and allowing our veterans to get their MRIs here or their x-rays here, not having to go to Roseburg, their dental work, eye care, things like that, it brings those dollars here locally too, right?
Yeah, it does. It brings the dollars here, but it also helps sustain the services here that perhaps may not otherwise be sustainable. So not only do the veterans benefit by having those services available locally, but non-veterans who need those same MRI services or whatever services they may be, the local health healthcare infrastructure may not be able to financially sustain those services based on just the non-veteran community. So now if we're bringing the veteran community dollars and service response into the community, it makes those services more sustainable for everyone.
So the most important thing I think that came from that was a demonstration of community cohesiveness too. I appreciated that our VA healthcare system director, Douglas Paxton, through his public information officer, Sean, gave our community and our efforts a resounding 10 out of 10 rating that we accomplished what we set out to do, and that is to make healthcare, mental health care for our Curry County veterans more accessible at a local level, so they don't have to take those long drives back and forth to Roseburg or White City, and many services can be provided locally. It was a very powerful experience to see you, Gary, all three veteran mayors, Commissioner Susan Brown, CEO of Curry Health Network, Jenny Razzo, and so many other great folks from Curry Community Health and veterans community members like VBA Chapter President Bill Farrell. This was truly our cities and county on fire for our veterans. And so on behalf of our Wild River veterans community, we're grateful everybody's support means the world to me personally. And the feedback and the way that the veterans community works is word of mouth. And that's the best advertising. And the word is out that veterans are supported in a way that they've never been supported before. And just that can, in and of itself, knowing that the moral support and the recognition and the awareness is there, can help be one of the good factors contributing to a good perfect storm rather than a bad perfect storm when it comes to addressing things like our veteran suicide rate. So thank you for being there. Thank you for sticking out through the whole meeting and for the encouragement and support of our veterans from the city of Brookings. So annexation, we had to get to this topic at some point. Curry Coastal Pilots front page news, February 24th. Headline said, CHETCO project moves forward. Jane Stebbins wrote the article, and she did a great job trying to encapsulate all of the different perspectives. The city council approved the annexation of the Tribble property along the CHETCO River, which passed by a 4-1 vote in favor of annexation. This is kind of a complex issue, so can you lay out the most important details and what was done to address the matter related to environmental impact on the estuaries in our area?
Okay, it is quite an involved topic, so I'll try to hit the high points here. This is a parcel of property, involves a parcel of property that is on North Bank CHETCO River Road, between North Bank CHETCO River Road and the CHETCO River. It's vacant. It's a piece of flat property that is owned by Mahar and Tribble. And they've been pursuing the possible development of that property for housing for several years now. They came up with a variety of alternatives for trying to provide sewer service to the property, several of which the city found unacceptable. The city has insisted that no septic systems or modified septic systems, as were originally proposed, would be acceptable on the property to protect the environment, that they would need to connect to the city's sewer system. They initially decided not to go forward with annexation to the city and connection to the city because of the expense. And they then went to the county to try to get approval for a lower density residential project. And after some discussion with the county and starting the process there, they then returned to the city and renewed their efforts to get the property annexed into the city limits and move forward with connecting to the city water and sewer system and doing a subdivision of up to 59 residential units on the property. The concerns that have been expressed by folks who have concerns about the project ranged from a perception that the project is too close to a flood inundation zone on the CHETCO River, that it's had standing water on the property observed in the past during heavy rain periods, that drainage from the property is going to go into the CHETCO River and have an effect on the environment, the fish species, and the environment of the river. There's an area, kind of a little bay, if you will, area near the property that is considered to be the a spawning area for salmon. It's the area where Ferry Creek discharges into the CHETCO River. So there have been a number of environmental concerns raised by citizens in the community and others. And the city council, when they approved the annexation, they weren't approving the project, but they were approving the annexation, knowing well that the project would be coming soon. It was appealed twice, I believe, to the Land Use Board of Appeals of the state, and they remanded it back to the city for further studies and evaluation of specific environmental concerns. So at the last council meeting, the council was considering the applicant's response to the latest LUBA remand, and found that the applicant's response dealing with how water being discharged from the property into the river would be controlled was acceptable, at least on a 4-1 vote. They found that that was the case and approved the response to the LUBA decision and making the annexation go forward. One of the council members raised a number of environmental concerns, which were detailed in a 2.5-page written document that he presented at the meeting, and which is utilized quite extensively in the Stevens article. There have been a number of meetings and discussions prior to that, which have a lot of detail about council members being interested in promoting housing and promoting the development of the site with minimal environmental impacts, including getting the if it's going to be developed, getting the sewage off that site and not having those septic systems. The site has been zoned and used for industrial purposes in the past. So this is I think council members in the past have also expressed that they feel that this is a better use than a continuing industrial use for the site. So there have been a lot of controversies, pros and cons about this proposed development. And I'm not sure if it's going to be further appealed. Now we look forward to seeing an actual development plan coming from the developer, and that will generate a new round of public comment and discussion about the project.
And the good news is, whenever there's a situation like this, people start to get more involved. And I think that's huge. And I'm encouraging civic engagement no matter which side of the issue a citizen is on. But, you know, our early conversation was the voters are the ones that really matter. And so supporting or being involved in the political process and participating in local government is important, not just to our senior citizens or our yuppie types or our, you know, more eclectic groups and our veterans group, but to young people. So I really appreciate when I see a young person sitting in a special seat at the city council, and I'll have you explain why that young lady is there. She's a high school student, and what her vote was, because that kind of gives us a little insight into our youth, and I think that empowers youth. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I will. But first, I wanted to mention that there were some folks in the audience at the council meeting who wanted to speak on this topic. This matter has been the subject of numerous public hearings, and at some point, the public comment ends, and the council needs to make a decision. So that's what was on the agenda for this meeting, is that while it said public hearing on the agenda, and that's the legal requirement, the public hearing was actually closed. The public comment portion of the hearing was closed, and the only public hearing aspects at this meeting were an opportunity for the applicant to respond to previous comments and for the city council to deliberate. So I know some folks left that meeting feeling that they weren't heard, but the opportunity for them to be heard, and at least one of them had spoken previously, that period was extensive. The public comment period was extensive, both in terms of physical hearings at the council meeting and literally thousands of pages of documents that were submitted by the public. That period concludes at some point, and the council needs to make a decision, and that's what they did on Monday night. But the role of the student council member, this is a relatively new phenomenon, something initiated by Mayor Hedenskog, to have a student advisory member of the city council sitting in on the council meetings, receiving the same packet of information that other councilors receive, who's invited to participate in the deliberations and in casting a advisory vote. In this case, while the official vote was 4-1 in support of the proposal, including the advisory vote, it was 4-2 because she apparently felt compelled to vote with Councillor Triglia in his opposition to going forward with the project or with the matter at this time. So I think it is a good opportunity for young people in the community to participate in the process, learn about the process, and make their thoughts known, and be able to express to their peers what happens in local government.
And I think that's huge because you and I've talked a long time ago about the fact that Southwestern Oregon Community College, our Curry campus, and I don't know that in Curry County at all, that they have a political science class. And I know that you used to teach that class, and I wish that we had political science at the JC level here in Curry County. And so I'm always going to advocate that as I can. And when I see something like this happening at the city council, where you have a young person as an advisor, how can we not have those kinds of classes? So there's my point of advocacy for today on behalf of a civic engagement and also involving our young people. Again, don't forget to register to vote. So also at Monday night's Brookings City Council meeting, there was some great Parks and Rec report, including Tony Barron talking about a grant application that will benefit Azalea Park. Can you tell us about what that grant is for and what could happen if the park were to get that grant funded?
Well, we're pursuing two grants from the Oregon Department of Parks and Recreation. And this is a part of an ongoing program to make improvements at Azalea Park. It's interesting. We have recently instituted a disc golf project at the park, which has been phenomenal in the number of people who are participating in that activity. And that has sort of melded into creating a new trail system around the park that's utilizing basically the disc golf course as the trail system. And have cleared out a lot of underbrush and made open the park up to greater use. We're also in the process of building a new restroom and snack shack facility over by the athletic fields. And that was partially funded by the Oregon Department of Parks and Recreation in a grant last year. So Tony Barron, our parks supervisor, has developed a master plan for the park that's been reviewed and approved by the Parks and Recreation Commission and the City Council that involves a reconfiguration of the fields, the creation of a standalone soccer field, some pathways that interconnect the athletic fields, make them more accessible, a children's play area, just a number of other improvements, and it's a phased program in about $200,000 to $300,000 increments. And part of the vision is to have those fields with an all-weather surface, all-weather surface, so that we can promote playing on the field through the winter. So the applications that he's submitting now are for additional phases of that project to continue developing towards this ultimate goal of having two all-weather baseball, softball fields and a soccer field with amenities in the park. The goals are not only to make that a more usable recreational facility for local residents, but also to try to attract additional events, additional tournaments to the area. Just this last week, we had, I think, the 30th annual, somewhere in the high 20s, 30s, Slippery Banana Softball Tournament. And that was hosted at more than one of the city parks. We had 48 teams of softball players, adult softball players, coming into the community. There were several local teams, but the great majority of the teams were from other places, with their 12 to 20 members and family members, and from each team, staying at motels, eating in local restaurants, contributing to the economy of the community. I know, for example, someone who works in the deli at Fred Meyer, who was called in at 4 o'clock in the morning to make sandwiches for all of these teams that are coming into town. So that's an economic activity that we can build on. We believe that with improved facilities, all-weather facilities at the parks, that we can attract more tournaments. This probably brought 800 or 900 people, and that's a really tremendous economic generator. So if we can get more of that activity happening here on the coast, even in the summer, I mean, think about the great sports facilities that they have over in Medford, where they've got people playing in 110-degree weather in the summer. Would it be attractive to have tournaments in Brookings during that period?
You and I are on the same page with that, because you know the backstory that one day I was sitting at my home in Mendocino County, and Skip Hunter returned from work and broke the news that we were going to be coaching softball, because they had just fired the previous softball coach. I said, I've never even thrown a softball or hit a softball. I played stickball as a kid. He said, yeah, but you can run those girls and work them in the weight room, help us do, you know, the workouts, and then you can teach them, you know, about nutrition and things like that. But really, he wanted me to make sure they did their studies and that they stayed academically eligible, and we got the fundraising done. But that was a real exciting thing, and we loved to go to tournaments. And of course, not just the players go, their boyfriends and their family members, and you know, it's a, like you said, it ends up being 900 people. And I've always liked the idea that, you know, Medford, when they do their 110-degree weathers, that, you know what, it would make a lot more sense and a lot more fun for young people, well, people of all ages, because tournaments can, you know, be for, you know, seniors, too. There are all kinds of different kinds of tournaments around baseball and softball. So I think that's a super idea. And, of course, I love everything that Tony's doing out there at the park. So have we forgotten anything that we need to talk about, Gary?
I think it's a pretty full agenda that we covered.
All right. Well, I always appreciate your time, because we extend our interviews because we actually have a listenership. You're building a listenership that not only gives us credibility, but also, I think it promotes that civic engagement. So next interview, let's be sure and talk about housing and employment and the airport, too. But as always, Gary, thank you. You're greatly appreciated. And come back soon, okay?
Well, thank you.
And I want to make sure I give credit where credit is due here today. A special thanks to Joyce Heffington, Brookings City Recorder, for all her assistance and support that she gives to KCIW and especially this show host. We ran into each other at Curry Health Network's Urgent Care 5th Street Clinic recently. And you know what? Life in a small town is precious. And I just appreciate the fact that today wasn't able to get my notes printed out, and Joyce did that for me. So she helped. She probably needs to get a producer's credit on this interview. So listeners, if you want to help out this great team, we need volunteers to help with recording, sound editing, and keeping the rest of us squared up. And feel free to visit our KCIW Facebook page and find out more. And our tech guys extraordinaire and tech gals extraordinaire are great at training people how to do sound editing. So if you want a transferable skill, learn it here and maybe go to work at a for-profit radio station if you're a young person. So thanks for joining us, Connie Hunter, Curry Coast Community Radio, Community Conversations.
Thank you for listening to Curry Coast Community Radio, your community-supported radio station. If you like this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio by volunteering your time or contributing to our capital campaign to help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org.
The opinions expressed in this program are those of the participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.